Hello and welcome to the MJA podcast. My name is Kate Swanell and I am the journal's news and online editor. Today we are talking about childhood obesity with Professor Louise Bauer, the head of child and adolescent health at the University of Sydney. Apologies in advance for my snorts and snuffles throughout this. I had the dreaded lurgy. That's a technical term, obviously. So how's Australia doing in terms of childhood obesity? Where are we in the world?
Well, like many other countries around the world, we have a large number of children affected by overweight and obesity. Of course, countries such as the Pacific Islands, the Caribbean, Middle East, and the Americas really are struggling with the issue. However, if we look at the OECD countries, obesity prevalence in Australia, we're number 5 for girls and 8 for boys. We're behind the USA, which is number 1 in the OECD, and behind also New Zealand. But I don't think we should take pride. We still have a large number of children who are affected. If we're talking in terms of overweight and obesity, then about 1 in 4 school-aged children are affected.
Wow.
If we're looking at obesity, then probably something between about 6 to 8% of school-aged children are affected by obesity.
If you could put your finger on one big driver of that, what would you point at?
That's a hard question to answer with one driver.
Yeah.
My main comment would be the 21st century. But we have dramatic changes in our food environments and also our physical activity environments over the past few decades. So we've seen the rise of readily available, cheaper food, often low quality food, junk food.
Yep.
We've seen the marketing of junk food and soft drinks to children and young people, the relatively higher price of better quality foods. We've seen the rise of motorised transport and of sedentary behaviours, of screens. The world comes to children now.
Yes, it does.
The way that it didn't used to. So there have been dramatic changes, both on the physical activity side, but also on the food side. All of these have had an effect.
I live in a suburb, in a regional town, and I remember being 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, and I was never off my bike. And I was thinking the other day, you just don't see kids on bikes in suburbs anymore.
Indeed. When I was a child, lots of children used to ride their bikes to and from school.
Yeah, absolutely.
That same school, because I've gone and checked it out, does not allow children to ride their bike to and from school. The school is concerned about safety en route. Parents, I think, have become more concerned about pedestrian and road safety of children. We are far more motorised now than we were some decades ago. Parents are concerned and school authorities are concerned about pedestrian and road safety. Some of that is real and some of that, I think, is more an imagined concern. So we have somewhat bubble-wrapped children, so it's more difficult for them to get this active transport or the incidental activity just by getting around and seeing your mates and spending time outside. We have cocooned children quite a lot.
How has the built environment changed and how has that affected the way kids get exercise or activity or just get outside?
This depends a little bit upon where you live. In many parts of the big cities, we've seen the rise of motorways, much more car transport, and in fact, a lot of planning focused on that rather than on green space, walking areas and so on. So if you invested in public transport that allowed buses and trains, et cetera, to link up and that had really good walking paths or places where it was easy for people to get there, you'd see more people being able to do that. But that's often a secondary consideration. Often the car rules in many areas around our country. So if there are more cars on the road, it is somewhat less safe to walk across them as a pedestrian. And if you're a young child, the parents naturally have some concerns. We've also seen, even with some of the high-density building that's happening more and more in inner urban areas, we're not necessarily seeing an associated investment in green space immediately around where children, young people, their families and older people can use those spaces. What we're talking about here are strategies that don't just help children and young people, help everyone, even a more walkable, physically active environment. And I don't think we've been investing in that. In fact, we've been disinvesting in what we've previously had.
It feels like there are so many vested interests fighting this need for us to look after our health better. It just seems kind of overwhelming sometimes.
I agree with you. What I do know is that there are very strong commercial interests, marketing, food industry and so on, that want to see their products sold. Now, of course, we need to have good food products available. We all want to be able to have good quality foods available. We want them to be ready and around for us. Often the foods that are really marketed and heavily sold are those that are poorer quality. And that's a challenge because these are some of the factors that have changed some of the ways in which we eat.
What have we been doing to help overweight and obese kids? And are those interventions working? And what do we need to add into that mix?
If you're asking about how do we treat children already affected by obesity, then I think we've got a reasonable degree of evidence about the elements of interventions or treatment that should be provided.
Yep.
Number one, I would say that if people are concerned about their weight, then actually they do need some form of treatment provided, and that outcomes in children and young people with obesity are generally somewhat better than they are in adults. So there is a sense of hope in being able to do this. But first of all, you need to have services. And of course, in many places around our country, there are very, very few treatment services for children and young people or families affected by obesity. You need health professionals, doctors, nurses, allied health, who are actually trained in this area. And we haven't had as much training in this area because it's a 21st century disease. Many people emerge from university into a health profession with very little training in this issue.
I'm chatting today with Professor Louise Bauer, Head of Child and Adolescent Health at the University of Sydney. Louise is the lead author on a narrative review on paediatric obesity, which you can find at mja.com.au.
But we do know that the elements of treatment, I think these are the elements that can be provided by GPs in secondary and tertiary level services as well. Not just GPs, nurses and allied health professionals all play an incredible role in providing treatment for those affected by obesity. For example, are there comorbidities?
Mm-hmm.
Should they be treated? Does this child have obstructive sleep apnea or insulin resistance or orthopedic problems? Will they need to be treated? We need to engage the family treatment. It needs to be developmentally appropriate, the way you treat a four-year-old. Different from the way in which you'd treat a 14-year-old. And you also need to support the family around long-term behavioural change. This is a whole-of-family activity, but people won't be surprised to think that it involves looking at healthy food intake, physical activity and sedentary behaviours. And there are a number of simple messages that can be given around eating well, eating as a family, eating breakfast, drinking water, appropriate snacks, etc., that are pretty simple, straightforward. Of course, in those with more severe obesity, then there are some other strategies that need to be considered. For example, you may need more specialist dietetic support and more intense dietary interventions. There is a role for some medications, although our armamentarium for treating obesity is very limited, particularly in childhood adolescents. And then for some with more severe obesity who are older adolescents, there is the role of bariatric surgery. So there's a range of things to consider. But first of all, I'd encourage people to actually ensure that people are actually being assessed and being offered the basic lifestyle behaviour change support, which everybody needs to take on board and be supported to do.
What's the thinking these days about the bariatric surgery? Well, what sort of age limits are we talking about? What kind of BMI limits are we talking about?
I chaired the Australia-New Zealand group from a College of Physicians, College of Surgeons, that developed the first consensus guidelines that we had for these, and they've been around for about almost 10 years. And they basically say it needs to be an adolescent and probably from about 15 years and up who has a BMI of 35 with comorbidities or a BMI of 40 without comorbidities. So most young people, if they're considering bariatric surgery, they'll probably have some comorbidities. So a BMI of 35 or above, it needs to be done by a highly experienced bariatric surgeon in a unit that's affiliated with a group that has experience in dealing with adolescent obesity. There also needs to be long-term follow-up, i.e. lifelong follow-up, because we need to know the long-term effects of this, and there needs to be support prior to and certainly after in helping the young person and their family usually, in terms of long-term behaviour change as well. At the time we made the recommendations, we made the recommendation around laparoscopic gastric banding. However, since then we've seen the rise of sleeve gastrectomy, and I suspect that if we looked at this again, we'd have a slightly broader array of, you know, more than one surgical option.
Yeah.
I think the basic message is, though, that you need a highly experienced surgeon who's used to dealing with adolescents, and you need to be linked into an adolescent medical service that has, you know, some form of multidisciplinary service that that's used to dealing with adolescents. But the most important thing is that it needs to be also available to young people. And sadly, exactly. In most places around Australia, it's still very, very difficult to get in the public system, especially if you're an adolescent.
Louise, if you had a magic wand, what would be the first thing you'd fix?
I'd like to make obesity the main issue and part of Prime Minister and Cabinet and then Premier and Cabinet. I'd like it to actually be that important an issue, or possibly Treasury. This is not to say we haven't had good health ministers doing great jobs, but if you think about the drivers of obesity, if you're thinking about preventing it in the first place, then they essentially all lie outside the health system. The health minister needs to know it's important too, because we need to have really good treatment services at both state level and also at more broadly at a federal level. It is tricky, isn't it, being able to make, sometimes to make this case. I have no doubt that the health ministers at both federal and state level are very aware of the costs of obesity and of some of the drivers of obesity and some of the strategies that may need to be addressed. I would be incredibly surprised if there were any health minister around our country who still thought that it was a role of personal responsibility. We know that that is a nonsense, that people essentially are responding physiologically to a pathological environment, and the pathological environment is called 21st century Australia. But it is challenging being able to make that call and to highlight this issue, because obesity still remains highly stigmatised. Most of us take on board the standard community concerns about obesity, where there's still a lot of stigma there. It costs a lot of money. For people affected, it can have profound health and psychological consequences, and we need to get beyond blaming people for this and get on to treating it and also preventing it. If we think about how it influences problems such as type 2 diabetes and also osteoarthritis, heart disease, etc., and we look at the rise in obesity in the general population, we realise how important that is. We don't, and I don't want to see children emerging into adulthood with lots of risk factors for heart disease and diabetes. That's not what should be happening.
Thanks for your time, Louise. My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.